From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new movie Get Carter opened today. It's a remake of the cult film about a hitman avenging the murder of his brother. On today's archive edition, we hear from Michael Caine, who starred in the original and is featured in the remake. We'll also hear from Mike Hodges, the director of the original Get Carter. He also directed Croupier. The West Wing started its new season this week with a two-hour episode. We'll hear from John Spencer, who plays the president's chief of staff, Leo McCary. He started his career as a regular on The Patty Duke Show. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Yugoslavia's ousted president Slobodan Milosevic met with opposition leader Vojislav Kostunica today. The nation's highest court had ruled Kostunica the victor in the recent presidential election after popular uprisings reached a fever pitch yesterday. Milosevic also addressed the nation by television today.
I plan to rest, to spend some more time with my family, especially with my grandson Marco, and after that to continue to reinforce my party.
President Clinton pledged today that the U.S. and its allies would work to lift sanctions against Yugoslavia and bring it out of isolation following the ouster of Milosevic. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says it is concerned about the long-term impact of the Israeli-Palestinian clashes on children in the West Bank and Gaza. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UNICEF reports 17 young people have died so far in the fighting between Israelis and Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Most were between 12 and 18 years old. Lynn Geldof of UNICEF says the turmoil will have a lasting effect.
80% of the injured are under 18 years. UNICEF is worried about the long-term impact of renewed violence on children's sound development. They're living now in a state of anxiety and fear.
UNICEF has set up a task force to deal with emergency needs. The group has asked the UN for $1.6 million in emergency health and relief supplies. An additional $15,000 is being used to buy emergency household supplies for 39 families who lost their homes in rocket attacks. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
The Supreme Court of Ivory Coast has barred the country's main opposition leader and former prime minister from candidacy in the upcoming election to return the nation to democratic rule. The court said Alassane Ouattara does not fulfill nationality conditions under a new constitution approved in July. The court approved the candidacy of military ruler General Robert Gaye, who, along with soldiers, staged Ivory Coast's first coup last December. Tension mounted today as a state of emergency and curfew came into effect. Troops were reported patrolling empty streets to head off potential riots by Ouattara supporters. Stocks fell sharply today. Worries over profits rattled technology shares, and an unexpected drop in unemployment rekindled fears of inflation. That, in turn, drove the manufacturing, retailing, and financial sectors lower. The Dow Industrials were down 128 points at 10,596, with decliners leading advancers by a margin of 5-2 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite was down 111 at 3361. This is NPR News. The government says the nation's unemployment rate tied a record low in September. NPR's Chad Pergram reports.
The decline was unexpected and came after 2 months of rising joblessness. The unemployment rate dropped to 3.9%, matching a 30-year low also reached in April. The rate for blacks also hit a monthly low. David Littman, economist at Comerica in Detroit, says the figure improved because firms continue to add service positions.
It means we have a lot of momentum in the U.S. economy. It would be very difficult, either through internal or external shock, to break the momentum of gains in employment, income, earnings, and optimism.
The jobs picture also improved after 87,000 telecommunications employees returned to work after the end of a strike against Verizon Communications. Chad Pergram, NPR News, Washington.
Stalking by way of the Internet would become a federal crime under a provision the House approved with a larger crime bill today. The cyber-stalking measure was included by Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison of Texas. Hutchison said new technologies have brought new crimes, requiring new laws. The House legislation passed overwhelmingly. Senate approval is expected next week. The cyber-stalking measure carries potential federal penalties of 5 years to life in prison. The Navy today awarded what was described as the biggest known contract for data services. The deal with Electronic Data Systems Corporation could be worth more than $10 billion over 8 years. EDS will build a seamless, secure intranet or internal internet service to replace the more than 200 current electronic gateways used by the Marine Corps and the Navy. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and Amgen, advancing the frontiers of medicine and improving the lives of patients through biotechnology.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Get Carter opened today. Sylvester Stallone stars as a hitman who returns to his hometown to avenge his brother's murder. Get Carter is a remake of the 1971 British film of the same name, which starred Michael Caine. In the remake, Caine plays the former boss of the murdered brother. Here's Stallone and Caine in a scene from the new film.
Where's Eddie?
He's not working today.
Where's he live?
Well, what's going on?
Where's he live?
Jack. Will you listen to me for just a minute? I've been in it all my life on both sides of the ocean. And I'm telling you this, if you get mixed up in whatever it was your brother was into, you've got a pretty good chance of winding up exactly the same as he did. And those two ladies are going to have to go into mourning all over again. Now, I can't tell you what to do, but I can tell you this. Getting yourself killed won't bring Richie back. Revenge doesn't work.
Sure it does.
The 1971 British version of Get Carter isn't well known in America, but a British Film Institute survey of England's top 100 films ranked Get Carter number 16. The film marked the directorial debut of Mike Hodges, who recently directed the film Croupier. Last May, when I spoke with Hodges about Croupier, we also talked about his 1971 film Get Carter. Pauline Kael said, in praise, I think, there's nobody to root for but the smartly dressed sexual athlete and professional killer in this gangland picture, which is so calculatedly cool and soulless and nastily erotic that it seems to belong to a new genre of virtuoso viciousness. Now, you adapted the movie from a novel by Ted Lewis. You wrote the screenplay and you directed it. Why did you choose this kind of really nasty story for your first film?
During the 60s, I'd worked on a program called World in Action, which is kind of like your 60 Minutes, only we would do just one item. And I'd really seen the underbelly of life just about everywhere. I went to Vietnam. I was in Dallas in 1964 doing a program with the Maisel brothers on Barry Goldwater as the Republican nominee. I'd done a program on Freemasonry, which had been banned in my own country because most of the board of directors turned out to be Freemasons, which not surprising, so it never got out on the air. And I just had basically observed in my own country a great deal of hypocrisy and a great deal of corruption. And we always had such a grand view of ourselves. Our police were wonderful. You know, it was American cops. It was, you know, that were corrupt. And there was no such thing as corruption here. And all of that changed really in the late 60s when we had some unbelievably vicious villains, basically some criminals, the Cray brothers and the Richardson brothers. So when I was offered this film, whilst I would readily admit that I took it on because it was my break into feature films, I took it on also because I could make a film that I thought would try to show a completely different side to the British character. Many of the elements in Get Carter were based on a factual story, and it is a cruel film, you're quite right. But I decided that if I was going to make it, it had to be as ruthless as as I could make it, actually.
No one is redeemed at the end of this movie. There's no moral resolution. Did that suit you as a filmmaker?
Again, I think that when you're dealing with people like Carter, and the people that he uncovered when he goes north to that town of Newcastle, none of those people are redeemable. It's interesting. There is a remake being made with Sylvester Stallone, which I'm now told is a redemption movie. So it's very interesting that
figures.
There's more money in redemption, I think, to be honest with you. I couldn't possibly. The thing that I did insist on, which they tried to talk me out of, was Carter's demise at the end of the film, and that I absolutely insisted on. And it was always in the original script, and I never wavered from that moment. And that he had to be dismissed in exactly the same way as that he dismissed all the other people who got in between him and his revenge. And that I would not deviate from.
Why?
Because I thought that the justice was there. It was built-in justice. I do believe that your life ends up much the way that you lived it. So Carter had lived by violence, and he would end violently. I mean, it's not always the case, but it is to a large degree, I think.
Michael Caine is really terrific in Get Carter. His body language and his speech are so perfect. And he's obviously a really cold guy, but he could turn on the charm. He could be funny in a really nasty way. And there are those moments where you can tell that there is some kind of heart beating underneath all of that. Let me play a short clip from the movie. In this scene, the Michael Caine character, the hitman, has just gotten to Newcastle. He's gotten there in time to see his brother laying in state before the cremation, and now he's going to avenge his brother's death. So one of his first stops is at a racetrack where he finds someone who he assumes is in on his brother's murder. His name is Eric. He's wearing a chauffeur uniform, and Michael Caine's trying to see what he's up to. And, of course, Eric is a little concerned about Michael Caine having come by.
I would be too.
Yeah.
So who are you working for these days, Eric?
Oh, I'm straight. Respectable.
What are you doing? Advertising martini.
Oh, you've been watching television.
Yeah. Come off it, Eric. Who is it? Brumby? Kinnear?
What's it to you, anyway?
Well, I've always had your welfare at heart, Eric. Besides which, I'm nosy.
Well, that's not always a healthy way to be, is it?
And you should know, if I remember rightly. So, you're doing all right then, Eric. You're making good.
Making a living.
Good prospects for advancement, is there? Huh? A pension? Do you know, I had almost forgotten what your eyes look like. They're still the same. Piss holes in the snow.
Still got a sense of humour.
Yeah. Yes, I'll retain that, Eric.
Well, that was a scene from Mike Hodges' first film, Get Carter, made in 1971. You were so lucky to have Michael Caine to work with in your first film, and then you worked with him again in your movie Pulp. Did you learn things about acting and directing actors from watching Michael Caine act and directing him?
Oh, well, you could not. I'd worked with actors before, but Caine's technique was impeccable, I must say. His knowledge of filmmaking was impeccable. I have to say that Clive Owen is much the same. It's this kind of extraordinary sense of filmmaking. So the hitting of the marks and the understanding of what the camera is actually doing was amazing. And, of course, I was pushing Michael, because if you look at Carter, there are scenes in there, again. For example, there was this one scene in his landlady's the room he rents in Newcastle, where he brings a character back and he interrogates him, and there's a bottle of whiskey and so on. And I shot all of that scene in one, Now, and a lot of it on Michael Caine's back. And I sort of, looking back, I had a lot of chutzpah, actually, because you'd been led to believe that stars wanted preferential treatment and they wanted their close-ups and so on. Michael was never like that. So I could do things with him that I probably wouldn't be able to do with other major stars. So in that sense, I was terribly lucky. And I was allowed that kind of freedom. He went with me completely in the way that I wanted to direct the film.
Mike Hodges directed the original 1971 version of Get Carter. He also directed the recent film Croupier. By the way, like he said, the new remake starring Sylvester Stallone is about redemption. Coming up, we'll hear from the star of the original Get Carter, Michael Caine, who's featured in the remake. This is Fresh Air. The new remake of Get Carter stars Sylvester Stallone as a hitman who returns to his hometown to avenge his brother's murder. It's a remake of the 1971 British cult film, which starred Michael Caine. In the remake, Caine is featured as the former boss of the murdered brother. Caine first established himself in the movie Alfie as a playboy and in The Ipcress File as a secret agent. He won an Academy Award for his role in the recent film The Cider House Rules and another for his role in Hannah and Her Sisters. He also starred in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Mona Lisa, Educating Rita, and Dressed to Kill. I spoke with him in 1992 after the publication of his autobiography, which told his story from his birth in the charity ward of a hospital to his coming of age in a working-class neighborhood and his rise as a movie star. I asked him about playing gangsters and killers and what he does to convey that sense of power.
Authority is shown not only by voice but by movement, and what it is first thing in authority is you never move. Only people who are trying to attract your attention with no power move their hands. If you look at aristocracy and really powerful people, they move very little because everybody is awaiting their every word, wish or command, and their voice is very, very slow because everybody will wait while they have their thought and wait no matter how long it takes for them to say what they're going to say. What you have to add in this case where I played a gangster, which would be menace, and menace would come if you were, I had a gangster accent, which is again a working class Cockney accent, but there is a sort of cheerful, chirpy working class sort of hello lads, let's all go down the pub and all this, you know, that sort of accent for the chirpy Cockney lad, cheerful little soul. But then there's another one, which is, it's kind of very drawn out, and it's very flat. And so they will actually say things to you. I grew up with gangsters like this, and they will say, I like you. And there's absolutely no emotion in the voice whatsoever. It's like an icicle. You know, they say, I think you're one of the nicest fellas I've ever met. Really do. I really think you're very nice. So, and then they say silly little things. When you know you're in trouble with a Cockney gangster, he'll say something like, well, who's been naughty then? Now, that question means you're probably going to get kneecapped to the floor. But it's one of those things of just flattening the voice out. The voice just flattens right out. No matter what you say, it just flattens.
Now, when you say you're in a position of power and authority, you don't move a lot.
No.
That means you don't blink a lot, too.
No. Oh, that's a trick for actors on film that I used and it was told. I think the first place I heard it was Marlene Dietrich who said it first, is that you don't blink. If you blink on camera, it signifies weakness. It's very difficult to do this trick on radio about blinking. But if you look in the mirror yourself and just stare and start saying things to yourself, you'll see how powerful it is. And if you just blink once in the middle of it, you'll see how it all dissipates. It just dissipates the whole thing. And, of course, if you're on a movie screen, you have to remember when you blink, each eyelid is somewhere between 2 to 7 feet wide if you're in a close-up.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Well, how do you learn to not blink? It's hard to not blink. Your eyes start to hurt. You can do it for a little bit, but after a while, it's a real strain.
You just walk around. I walked around all my life. When I was a young lad, I wrote this about this in the book. When I was a young lad, I found a book in the public library, How to Teach Yourself Film Acting. And the first thing it said in it is, you must not blink. And so I walked around. I walked around this sort of working class district of London, which was used to some very rough people, you know, without blinking. And I looked like a sort of early serial killer. I'm sure I frightened the life out of people, because I used to have long conversations with people and never blink. And I would watch people getting hypnotized. And they would walk away from a quite simple conversation with me, quite flummoxed as to what went on.
Well, here's what I'm wondering, you know, since you learned, obviously, by making movies, how did you pick up everything that you know now about how to look into a camera, or how, like, where to look when the camera's looking at you? Did you pick that up over years after watching yourself and watching yourself?
No, I never watch myself. I never see rushes, and I only see the finished film once, just to see how it turned out and who goofed, including me. And film is listening, reaction, and behavior. That's what film acting is. It shouldn't be called film acting at all, because it's not acting. It's something entirely... Acting is what you do on stage, as far as I'm concerned. And people behave. The only time real people act is if they're showing off or trying to make an impression, like a guy with a girl or something. Then they act, and then they're artificial, and we can all see they're artificial because they're acting. But normally what you do is you listen and you react, and then you behave, and that's all it is. You'll see actors, like, for instance, making gestures on the phone with no one there. You don't make gestures on the phone with no one there. You think you do, but you don't. And so you get sort of strange things happening like that when you see actors acting.
Mm-hmm. Now, but what about where to look when the camera's looking at you? I mean, you really learned how to work
Yes.
in front of a camera. And if you didn't spend a lot of time watching yourself, how did you learn that?
No, well, I learned by watching where the camera was. I mean, for instance, you always... if you're going to... The thing is, if you're going to play a part, you're playing a part with another actor and you look in their eyes. And what you do, if you're acting, you suddenly go, well, how do I look into this person's eyes? Now, during your lifetime, you've looked into hundreds of people's eyes every time you speak to someone, but you can't remember how you did it. And what you do is you only look into one eye, because if you look into two eyes, you go cross-eyed. And the one eye you look into is the one that is nearest the camera, because that throws the one eye that you're not looking in, not using, straight into the lens.
Huh.
That's how you do that.
And how'd you learn that?
I figured it out. How to do it. I figured it out myself, actually. I figured out a lot of stuff myself, because you get a feeling in movies when you play someone, the actor should disappear and people should only see the person. I mean, it's a self-defeating thing in a funny way, because half the time people see me and they say, well, he's only playing himself. It's because I've made the actor disappear. And that's where you come down to this thing where you've got behavior and where you've got the camera. You can come down to the absolute minimum thing to do for the camera to pick up. And that's what's fascinating about film acting, because camera always finds it.
You were born, actually, not only working class, it was a really pretty poor family. You were born in the charity ward of the hospital. Your father was a porter at the fish market, your mother a cleaning woman. You spent several years in an apartment that had no electricity.
I never lived in a house that had electricity until I was 12 years old,
mm-hmm.
which was in 1948.
So what did your friends think of your ambition to act?
Oh, they thought it was completely ridiculous, utterly derisory. I mean, no one. I mean, I was just treated with absolute contempt by everybody, or ridicule.
Now, why ridicule? I mean,
because, well, for a start, people of my class and in that society never went into show business. No one knew anybody who was in show business or anything. And also, like my family, the male members of my family would regard any male going into show business or acting as being homosexual anyway, or a possible homosexual. There was a tremendous gay inference. I mean, we didn't use the word gay in those days. If you said, when I said to my father I was going to be an actor, it was the equivalent of telling him I was homosexual as far as he was concerned.
So did you feel that you had to do things to prove your manhood while studying acting?
No, I was already doing those, but my father didn't know about it.
I think I get what you're saying.
Yes. But I really had to prove to him. I married very young, which I sometimes think was an effort to prove to him that I wasn't gay. And I had a child when I was 22. I had a daughter when I was 22. And of course, with his simple-minded way of looking at it, he was again wrong, because the fact that I was married and had a baby meant to him that I was definitely not a homosexual. And so he was wrong in both cases, you know, because there are a lot of people who are married with children who are homosexuals. But he had a very simplistic view of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a very, very tough man. I mean, and it's very hard to put across to anybody, to get across to anybody just how tough he was. Back again to the gay analogy, he actually thought that any man who ate chicken was gay.
Chicken?
Yes.
Why?
Because this red meat thing, you know, real men ate red meat and all this stuff, and he thought that was sissy food, chicken.
Did he ever come see you in a performance or
no.
See your movies?
No. No, he died. He died when I was completely out of work, completely broke. He died of cancer when he was 56 years old. One of my great regrets in my life is that his last memories of me was as a complete and utter disaster and failure. But at least he knew I wasn't gay because I had a wife and a child.
Right. Michael Caine, recorded in 1992, he starred in the original 1971 version of Get Carter and is featured in the new remake, which stars Sylvester Stallone. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Listening Hand, Self-Healing Through the Rubenfeld Synergy Method of Talk and Touch by Ilana Rubenfeld. This is NPR, National Public Radio. The West Wing started its new season this week with a 2-hour episode. The show's first season won 9 Emmys and a Peabody. Coming up, we hear from John Spencer, who plays the president's chief of staff. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The TV White House drama The West Wing made its season premiere this week with a two-hour episode. Last season ended with a cliffhanger. Who was shot when bullets were fired at a group which included the president, President Bartlett, his aides, and his daughter? This week, we learned that the president was wounded. His aide, Josh Lyman, was more seriously injured and barely pulled through. The episode also included several flashback scenes about how the characters first met. In this flashback scene, Leo McGarry, now the president's chief of staff, was organizing the presidential campaign for Governor Bartlett. They're in New Hampshire for the primary. McGarry has just fired several people on Bartlett's staff.
It's freezing cold in October. I don't know how you people live here.
Did you just fire Cal Memphis?
Yeah.
You fired him?
Yeah, and Jerry and Mac and Steve and the other guy.
Is there anyone you kept?
I kept Toby Ziegler.
Oh, you kept Toby Ziegler and you fired everybody else?
Yeah.
Toby Ziegler is the only person working for us I don't know, and he's the one you kept.
Take him home, would you?
Those were the only people I knew.
Those people were worthless. It's time we bring in what we need.
So you made that decision on your own?
Yeah. You know why? Because you're a crappy politician. I think you'll find I'll be making a lot of decisions on my own, so start getting used to it.
You know, I got elected to Congress by this state. This state sent me to Congress three times and then elected me governor, all without your help. Don't start.
No, seriously, that's a real political accomplishment considering your family founded this state.
Hey.
Were you even opposed in any of those elections?
You got rid of all the people I know.
Yeah. Have a good night.
Why are you doing this? You're a player. You're bigger in the party than I am. Hoynes would make you national chairman. Leo, tell me this isn't one of the 12 steps.
That's what it is. Right after admitting that we're powerless over alcohol and that a higher power can restore us to sanity. That's where you come in.
Leo.
Because I'm tired of it year after year after year after year, having to choose between the lesser of who cares, of trying to get myself excited about a candidate who can speak in complete sentences, of setting the bar so low, I can hardly look at it. They say a good man can't get elected president. I don't believe that, do you?
On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded a few months ago with John Spencer, who plays the president's chief of staff. I asked Spencer to describe his character.
Leo is a man who's very impassioned about what he does. I think he's politician in the best sense of the word, a caretaker, someone who is out for the ultimate good. I think he's a workaholic. I think he's a man who invests all of his passion and his time at the workplace and has very little left over for his family, which is why his marriage is in trouble. The evolution, I think, comes week to week. I think some of the rude awakenings of the amount of compromise that is necessary to run an administration, how you often have to give up A and B in order to achieve C and D. And I think that frustrates Leo. I think it frustrates Leo often the idealism of the inception of their ideas of what they want to accomplish this administration and the reality there of what they can accomplish. I think that often disappoints him.
When you get a script, do you read through the whole thing straight through, or do you go just to your part first and see what's up for your character?
I read through the whole script. One of the things, I was mentioning this to someone yesterday, one of the really positive things about the show and why I know it's as good as I feel it is I and the rest of the cast, I mean, we get the new script sometimes hot from the oven. It's still, the pages are still warm from the duplicating machine. And we immediately, all of our heads are in the script looking, what happens to our character? What happens to this person? So there's a great enthusiasm and interest in what's going to happen for the cast. And I can't imagine if we're that interested that other people who are not into the daily grind of making this show wouldn't be interested. So I take that as a good sign.
I'm wondering if there's ever something in the script that you think doesn't work and has to be redone, rewritten.
With Aaron's writing, for the most part, I would say 99% of the time, there's nothing that I would change. Every once in a while in charting the character's growth, I will have a question like, well, why would Leo come out on this side of this given all of that? and I'll usually talk to Aaron about it, and he'll explain it, and I'll understand it, or I'll not agree with it, and we'll talk it out, and either it'll be tweaked, as he puts it, changed a little bit, or he'll convince me that this is the way the character would behave.
Let me ask you about something that happened in a recent episode.
Mm-hmm.
Your character is a former alcoholic.
That's right.
Who hasn't touched a drink for several years. I forget
right.
how many.
8.
Recently, the fact that he had been to a rehab center was made public by a kind of new aide in the White House. So
mm-hmm.
someone who is very young and very new to this kind of job. Was she an intern?
She was an intern.
Yeah, she worked, okay.
Yeah, she worked in the administration office. She really didn't work in the West Wing itself. She was in administration, but that gave her privy to files.
Well, so she secretly makes this file public, you know, that you were in rehab.
She leaked it to a friend socially.
Yeah.
And who was in the opposite political party, and he took the football and ran with it.
And it gets into the press, really big story.
Absolutely.
Very, very difficult for the White House to handle.
Absolutely.
One friend of yours suggests that you resign. He's no longer your friend, I think.
That's right.
And then when the story is traced back to the intern, she's fired. She comes into your office because you've
mm-hmm.
invited her in.
Mm-hmm.
You talk it through, and then you tell her to keep her job.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, I wonder.
Yeah,
chief of staff would really say to the intern who leaked something like this, go ahead, keep your job.
Mm-hmm. I read a thing in the New Yorker magazine where they felt that was one of the few elements of Aaron's writing on this show that they didn't totally buy, that we would hire this woman back. You know, that might not happen in real life. I had much less problem with it because I think it's a quick transition. I think it happens in the moment. And being in recovery myself for 10 years, I kind of have an intimacy with the rooms, with AA. And one of the precepts of the program is forgiveness and lack of proselytizing. Share your story. Don't do inventory on other people's points of view. Love and forgive constantly. And I think the turning point for Leo, which I had to find as an actor, I think it is a conversation. He plans to fire her. He asks her why she's done this. And in questioning why she did this, when she comes out with the fact that her father was an alcoholic and his irrationality and strange behavior was so aberrant to her, so horrifying, that this was the only other alcoholic she knew, and suddenly finding out that the chief of staff of the White House of the United States was also an alcoholic, her only point of reference was her old man, was her dad. And I can't imagine how horrific it must have been for her, thinking someone with these mood swings, someone who might act like this, is in such a seat of power where people's lives could be affected. And as she expresses that, I think myself as Leo have to realize, well, the motivation is a positive one. The result might have been horrible for me and for my friend the president and for our administration, but this woman, it was not kind of nasty, you know, water cooler gossip. It was someone who really feared that it could be very dangerous and to have a man with this weakness or this problem in this important position. And when I see that and I kind of note that she has a love of the government and a love of its responsibility, feeling that she was well-motivated, I think I have to give her a second chance. And God knows my character's been given through his life a lot of second chances. So how can you get and not give, you know?
Was the chief of staff character originally written as a recovering alcoholic, or was that aspect of his character written in after you got the part because of your own experience?
Yeah, good question, and often asked me. The truth of the matter is, it was not originally written that way. I have since, because I've been asked this question so many times, gone to Aaron and said, listen, how much did my life influence you there? Because we've talked very rarely about it. I mean, I remember one time going into the soundstage, and I was yet struggling again with the cigarette, no cigarette thing. And we were talking about addiction, and I said, well, this is the last threshold for me, and this is the hardest. And then I started talking about being in recovery. And I don't know if he knew about it before then or not, but it was a very light, casual conversation. And since the episodes have aired that cover this, I've been asked that question a lot because I'm not anonymous and people know that I'm in recovery. So I went to Aaron and I asked him if my life influenced his desire to put the character that way. And he said, absolutely not. He said, you know, it was part of his creative imagination, part of his own life experience, knowing people in recovery. And I triggered it off by saying I was in recovery, but he was not basing it on my life.
What episode has gotten the biggest response, and do you find that Democrats and Republicans respond to either different storylines or different aspects of the story?
I think Democrats and Republicans, people's political point of view comes into how they respond to the episodes. When our first episode went on, a lot of pundits sort of said, liberal, left-wing, Democrat, writer, Aaron Sorkin, writing a liberal White House, pro left, anti-right. And then, of course, Aaron, in his great talent, surprised everyone, turned around and made the liberal Democratic president want to bomb the Mideast after his friend went down in a plane. So we take everything on. He took on the Hollywood liberal agenda also, you know, these moguls who throw these fundraisers with their own agendas. So no one's safe with Aaron. He's taken on the right, the left, and the middle.
My guest is John Spencer. He's one of the stars of The West Wing. He plays the president's chief of staff, Leo McGarry. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Spencer, and he plays the White House Chief of Staff, Leo McGarry, on the series The West Wing. How did you get the part as the Chief of Staff on The West Wing?
I had just done a short-lived series for our executive producer, John Wells, a thing called Trinity, that was shooting in New York and was not well-received commercially. We couldn't get an audience. So we went off after 9 episodes. I really had a good time with that experience. My agent called me and said, I've just read a brilliant pilot. And I said, oh, no, not another hour drama. I just did that. And I wasn't sure I wanted to get involved again so soon with that, because there's a great luxury to being able to do one or two films a year. You have time off in between. You can make your nut. You get to play more than one character. So I wasn't sure I wanted to kind of, you know, sign on for the big ride again. And he said, well, read it. And I read it, and I'll tell you, I got maybe a third into it, and I just thought, this is some of the most brilliant writing I've ever seen for television. And I loved the role, and that's when I decided I really want to go after this one. So I chased it down like a wild man. I really went after it. I worked it up. I read it with Aaron, and apparently, if I can take Aaron and Tommy's word for it, after I read for them, they saw no more Leos, and I was the first person cast. So that makes me feel very good. I didn't know that at the time.
Now, were the other people cast with you to see if the chemistry would work?
We were sort of cast one at a time, I guess, as they found the people they thought best suited each of the roles. They told me I was cast first. I think Josh, Brad Whitford came along soon thereafter. Aaron says that this is the first time in his career that he got his first choice for all the roles. So that's very nice.
And when was Martin Sheen cast as the president?
Martin was cast, I believe he was one of the last people cast. And to start with, he was going to be recurring. He was only going to do about 5 or 6 of the 22 episodes. And then after we did the pilot, They reconsidered and they thought, well, we really just don't want to be talking about the president with the audience waiting to see him each week. So they asked him if he would, you know, sign on for the whole ride, and he was only too happy to. And here we are.
In TV, you're best known for your roles on L.A. Law and The West Wing. But your first recurring TV role was on The Patty Duke Show.
It certainly was.
As Kathy's boyfriend, the British identical cousin.
The British identical cousin, I forget, what was the role called? Henry Anderson, I think, was the guy's name.
You don't even remember.
Well, I was 16. I'm 53 now, so it was a while ago. Yeah. Well, what a lucky stroke. It was one of the first jobs I ever did in the show business, and it was a lucky break. I mean, they were basically casting what they saw is what they got. I had no training at the time, and I guess there was something in my personality that they thought suited that character, and that's what they got.
Why don't you refresh your memory and describe the character?
I was kind of goofy. It was, kind of a typical teenager in the 60s. I watch some of the reruns every once in a while, and I look particularly tall and skinny to myself with very big ears and kind of voice that cracked as it got up in the higher register. So it's almost at times if I see that, like I'm watching a different person, you know?
Were you in it from the first episode, or was the character written in later?
It was recurring. I was in the first episode, and I say I would maybe did 10 or 15 of the 22 of the first two seasons. And then the show moved to California because Patty turned 18, and it was working codes and things. She was not under the child labor law any longer, so they could easily do the show in California. And they didn't take any of the recurring people with them to California. So I was only on the first two seasons.
Did she get a new boyfriend?
Kathy? Kathy kind of played the field, as I remember.
She was such a swinger. No, she wasn't.
No, she wasn't. The other one was. Yeah. Do you remember the theme song?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, I do too.
Why don't you sing it? I'm not going to.
I can't sing it. I won't go near that. But it's amazing how many people do.
Now, when you were in high school when you got the role?
I was. Go ahead.
Well, could you walk down the halls of your high school without people singing the song to you?
Well, at that point, when I was about 16, I left my New Jersey home and moved into New York City, much to my parents' chagrin. And God bless them for ultimately letting me do this, as petrified as it must have made them. Now, as a 53-year-old man, I look back and realize the horror I must have put them through. And I was pretty rebellious, and I was pretty sure of what I wanted to do. I knew by 8 years old that I wanted to act. Why? Don't ask me. It just seemed a certainty for me in my mind. So I went into New York, and I didn't know the first thing about anything, let alone how to break into this elusive business that I wanted to be a part of. So I got a job I wasn't a waiter. They couldn't hire me as a waiter because I was too young and I didn't have working papers. So I was a busboy. And then I found out when the summer was over that I had to go to school if I wanted to work, because I had to get things called working papers. And I needed that up to the point that I was 18. So I enrolled in this high school called Professional Children's School. Not like the Fame High School. We were not taught craft things. We were not taught singing, dancing, acting. It was just academics, but it was academics for children, teenagers, high school students, who had working lives. I was in school with Pinchas Zukerman, who at that time was a concert violinist, has since become a very famous conductor. Famous ice skaters, ballet dancers, all of the New York City Ballet was in that school. Actors, we had some rock singers. It was a very eclectic mix of teenagers.
For a lot of people who grew up with the Patty Duke show, they probably thought that, like, one day they'd be old enough to go to the malt shop with a date.
Oh, I know.
And, I mean, did the whole idea of what being a teenager was on the Patty Duke show affect your idea of what it meant to be a teenager?
We were kind of different teenagers, a little more jaded, a little more worldly wise, a little more out there. Because we had no time to go to the malt shops. We were either at the studio or trying to make up homework.
I'm not sure you could have found a malt shop like that in Manhattan.
We had a place called Rudley's, which was right by the school. It was a coffee shop. No longer there. The Gulf Western building is there now. And we would often, I'm talking out of school here, Terry. We would often cut classes and hang out there and drink Coca-Colas and eat English muffins and smoke cigarettes. A habit that I picked up early on and I'm still trying to get rid of.
It's hard. It is really hard.
Oh, boy. It seems to me my Achilles heel. This is now my third attempt. I stopped for 18 weeks and then very cavalierly over Christmas decided, okay, I'm strong. I'll have a few cigarettes. I'm on vacation. Well, there was a really stupid point of view because within 3 or 4 days I was smoking completely again.
Your character on West Wing doesn't smoke, does he?
Not at all.
That's good, because you wouldn't have to smoke. You wouldn't.
No, I
that would
made
really
that
hurt
as
to
a,
have to smoke to be in character.
Absolutely. I made that as a conscious choice. Also, the White House is a smoke-free area.
Of course.
So we'd have to run outside to have one. Do you smoke?
Oh, I gave it up a long time ago.
How'd you do that? Cold turkey, or did you use tools?
Well, I'll tell you what happened to me. I lost my voice twice on the air. Because I had a cold and I was smoking right through
it.
And I realized, you know, this is going to be really awful if I lose my voice again like this. So that it definitely inspired me to stop. And I didn't, I just stopped.
You did?
Yeah. I mean, I was sick when I stopped. I had a really bad cold, no voice. So it was easy to get through that and then keep going. But I had stopped, you know, an amazing number of times before that and started again.
It's a squirrely habit. It really gets you.
My guest is John Spencer. He plays the president's chief of staff on the TV series The West Wing. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with John Spencer. He plays the president's chief of staff on The West Wing. There are some actors who did some pretty great bits of business with cigarettes. You know, Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall. I mean,
absolutely.
You just you remember how they looked when they smoked. When you were starting acting and smoking, was a cigarette a really good prop for you?
Absolutely. I taught myself. I stood in front of a mirror in the upstairs bathroom and taught myself to smoke. I smoked and I thought, this doesn't look right. This doesn't look like other people. And so, you know, I kind of did that, holding them with the first three fingers.
Oh,
you know,
yes,
that kinda
right.
Tough look.
Yeah.
And then I thought, it still doesn't look right. And I realized I wasn't inhaling. I didn't know what inhaling was. So why isn't it coming out of my nose? And I took a deep breath and it came out of my nose. The room started spinning around. I was sick on the bed. And the next day I started again. And with enough practice, I learned how.
Do you have a favorite smoking scene from your movies?
From my movies? Let me think. Not really, but I loved the concept that David Kelly wrote my first episode of L.A. Law. Melania was a smoker, and they often let me smoke on that show. I believe after a while, the character became very popular, and NBC got very worried that I was a good guy smoking. And there was some pressure from the network that I shouldn't smoke on the show. But that came the second and third season. The first season, I smoked like a fiend. In fact, there was one scene I remember where Leland McKenzie, Richard Dysart walked in my, opened the door, and like smoke poured out of my office. But my first litigation, my first case was a secondary smoke suit where I got the client millions of dollars and attacked the cigarette companies where in between scenes I was smoking like a wild thing. And I loved that dynamic. I thought that was so great and so David Kelly, that kind of, complex situation.
You know, it's funny, a lot of actresses complain that when they hit their 40s, the roles dry up. Your career really took off in your 40s and 50s.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about why that is.
I do. I was a character actor in a young man's body. I don't think people knew what to do with me in my 20s, you know, because I wasn't Matt Dillon or I wasn't your typical young leading man, yet I also wasn't so much of a character actor that, you know, I could play the occasional really offbeat sidekick. I fell somewhere in the middle and therefore in the cracks. As my face began to age and more meet the roles, things got better and better. I'm one of those examples of it getting better and better with time. The older I got, the better it got. But my real view about acting is unless you need it like an opiate, unless you really, I mean, you jones for it, you can't live without it, I would do something else. There are so many other things that are easier on the soul, more lucrative, more steady. But if you need your art and it's undeniable to you, then you don't have a choice. That's why when young actors ask me, do I think they should act? I say no, because unless they know they have to act, I don't think it's worth it. It's hard enough when it's going well. If it's not going well, it's impossible.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
What a great interview. I can see why people like your show.
John Spencer plays the president's chief of staff on The West Wing. Our interview was recorded last spring. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Vintage Books Division, paperback publishers of Plainsong, the new novel by Kent Harriff. From Saab, introducing its new 2001 lineup, featuring the OnStar voice-activated telematics system. Information available at saabusa.com. And from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Expanded Quotable Einstein, available in bookstores or online at www.pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, the ups and downs of directing blockbuster movies. We talk with Joel Schumacher, who directed Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, as well as The Firm, 8mm, and Falling Down. He went the low-budget route with a cast of unknowns for his new film, Tigerland. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.